And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Wally Derleth and Tim Schnell are at the phones tonight, and we ask that you be a little patient when you call in, as we only have two volunteers, and Wally and Tim may have their hands full from time to time. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And welcome back, Cliff Shackelford.
Yes, good to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah, indeed. And it was a much nicer drive up this month than it was last month, was it not?
It sure was. And especially if you're like me and you started your morning in San Marcos, Texas. We were college shopping for our high school senior. And so we looked at Texas State University and drove back this morning and got back just in time to drop off everybody, and I can get another vehicle and keep heading east to Shreveport. So I've been on the road a bunch today.
You're getting ready to send one off to college, huh?
Yes. Good. There's good and bad to that, isn't there?
Well, you know, life is full of that. Every plus kind of has its minus to it. You want to see them grow, but you don't like the empty nest stuff.
Right.
Well, you know, you're a birder, so you can just adopt birds and have them live in the house.
Yeah. And you know, no bird stays at home till they're 17, 18, 19. So we're a little different, aren't we, than the birds?
But. Yeah, pretty much. We like to nurture a little longer than the birds. They're like, hey, you know, you're 8 months old. Get the hell out.
That's right.
Go feed yourself. I'm done with you. All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, tonight. And we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Also, any photos that you'd like Cliff to identify can be sent to my address, my email address, that is, wbeckett@lsus.edu. I'll be able to speak one of these days. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Well, Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip, and can you refresh our memories?
Sure. We talked about if folks, especially in Texas, are paying taxes on acres of rural land, and they're enrolled in tax valuations with their county that they have productive value on their property because they're in agriculture, they're in timber, to contact that appraisal office to see if you can switch to wildlife. If you're ready to get out of the business of ag and timber and to try to make your place more wildlife friendly, you can still have cows, just not like you did before. You can still do timber, just not maybe not like before, certainly not in, you know, tight rows like rows of corn. They're going to be a little different because that's, you know, that's one of the big reasons we don't have a lot of species of native birds is because of things like that, these rows of pine trees with nothing else growing under them. So we've talked about that a bunch on the show, why we don't have quail, for example. So contact your appraisal district. This is one thing that Texas has available. And if you're in another state, investigate if your state does that. Chances are they don't. Texas was the first to have this. Started in 95. It got perfected and refined and really got robust in about 2001. But if your state doesn't have it, you know, this is your opportunity to push for it and get your state to have not only an ag valuation, a timber valuation, but a wildlife valuation. I want to make it clear that this doesn't mean that you're tax exempt or tax free. It just means your property is valued differently. And we're doing this on some family property that we own in Cherokee County. And I'll tell you, it really changes your perspective of your property in a good way, because before we just, you know, we're like, okay, we got 120 acres, we're doing this, but this is more targeted, and you have to do at least three activities on your property. You can do more things like habitat control, erosion control, predator control, putting out supplemental food, putting out bird boxes, doing a census count. You can do a number of things under those broad categories, but you've got to do at least three. And I think it's really, really worthwhile because you look at your property differently. You respect what you're doing as a steward of the land that's going to benefit wildlife, mainly birds in my case. But I know it doesn't just stop with birds. Every wild critter is going to benefit when you're bringing habitat in better condition than it was before.
Return nature to its natural order, and nature shall return to its natural place.
That's right. So I do a lot of privet control, hog control. I do a bird census every early June. In the past, I've done things like created snags, because we've talked about how snags are valuable to wildlife. I've put up bird boxes. I've treated fire ants. There's so many neat things you can do that really help.
Define a snag again for our audience.
Okay, great. A snag is a standing dead tree. So it changes its name immediately when it falls to the ground to a log. Mm-hmm. So when dead wood is standing, it's a snag. When it's on the ground, it's a log.
And it's habitat when it's standing, is it not?
Yes, there's all kinds of beetles and other critters inside and fungi that are decomposing that tree that makes it soft. So certain birds can build cavities and raise young, and then when they're done with it, a wood duck might come along and use that hole if it's an old pileated woodpecker hole. Woodpeckers can forage on it. Owls can perch on those limbs. So it's absolutely a great little microcosm of stuff going on there.
And, of course, when it falls, it returns to the soil with other habitat.
Yeah.
Other critters take up a roost.
Yeah, and when it falls, actually, pileated woodpeckers don't stop feeding on them. Once they fall, you'll see a lot of pileateds feed on logs on the ground. There's still value depending on how old that tree. Depends on the species, too. And so there's a lot of value to that. And yes, you're right. It puts that nutrient load back into the ground as well.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And all lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can get right in now with your questions about birds and the avian world. And in the meantime, we have a profile species. And what do you have for us this month?
Right. Over the years, we've profiled over 70 species of birds on this show. And tonight, we are profiling our fourth species of duck, the lesser scop. Like most waterfowl, scop are not at all musical. So let's listen to a short clip we have of lesser scop's grunting here.
Sort of the punk rock of birds.
Yeah, pretty rough sounding grunting. You can hear other wetland sounds there, like red-winged blackbirds. But let's listen again. So those are lesser scops grunting. If you've never heard the name scop, it's spelled S-C-A-U-P. Duck hunter names for this species include dogree, bluebill, and broadbill. Because there's a lesser scop, guess what? There's also a greater scop, a lookalike, that when out on the water is not noticeably larger in size. To tell them apart, look at the shape of their head, especially when in a more relaxed state of loafing or floating instead of an active state of foraging and diving. The lesser scop has a taller, more peaked head, while the greater's head is lower and more gently rounded. When in flight, there are also slight differences in the amount of white on the upper side of the wings. The drakes of the lesser scop are mostly dark in the head and rear, but pale gray in the body, while the hens are mostly a dark brown overall with a noticeably bright white spot at the base of their bill. Watch for scop to be in any size flock on the water and sometimes mixed with other waterfowl. When gathered in the water, we call this a raft of scop. I've seen rafts of scop in the thousands along the Gulf Coast during winter and in spring migration. This is a diving duck, meaning that when it feeds, it completely disappears underwater, coming back up a few moments later, often several yards away from where it first dove. When combining all seasons of the year, the lesser scop has a widespread distribution across the entire U.S. and most of Canada. They're in just about any body of water, including small ponds, large lakes and reservoirs, and saltwater bays and gulf waters. To see a photo of a male lesser scop snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we do have photos that were submitted to us, and we always love to get these photos. First up is a photo sent by Jason Norman, who wrote, "I wish I had a better picture, but it's the only one that I had enough time to get. I saw this bird on our campus at LSUA. I don't recall ever seeing one before. Would you mind having Cliff identify that for us?"
Yeah, and he sent a really good picture of a scissortail flycatcher. And you can't mistake this bird. It's, you know, the body's about the size of a mockingbird, but then it's the males especially have this tail that's about double the size of the body. So a really long tail that it's dragging. The male's longer than the female. So, if people want to see these pictures, just go to our Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org, and you can see these as well.
Yeah, I see that tail, and I almost think of a peacock with them folded in, you know.
Yeah.
Just a very, very long tail.
Super
subsequently
long
to its body. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you, Jason, for sending that in. And Kim Smith sent in some audio, and we're going to take a listen to this real quick.
And that dominant thing calling there is a bird we profiled in March of 2021, just, 6 months ago or so. And that's the white-eyed vireo. And it's a very common songster in the listening area. Really throughout the eastern U.S., especially the southeast U.S., is a very loud songster that's very hard to see. They're very thicket-loving. They don't like to come out. We talked about that when we profiled it, and that's a really good recording. That was sent in. So thanks for the recording of the wide-eyed vireo.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have all lines open right now, so you can get right in with any question you have about birds, the avian world, or conservation, or anything else dealing with Cliff's expertise as an ornithologist. Give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502.
And I've got to do a shout-out to the ruby-throated hummingbird. In my backyard, our backyard, we have just been inundated starting around September 16th, which is about normal, but we have not – it went into early October that we did not really have a break from having just dozens of – ruby-throated hummingbirds in our Nacogdoches backyard. And I can't remember a better fall. So these are fall migrants. So it happens every year. If it opened your eyes this year, it's because you maybe weren't looking last year. But every September, starting in the middle of the month and going to the end of the month and continuing on into October, these are ruby-throated hummingbirds that bred to our north that are passing through. And believe it or not, they're not staying with you for very long. You might think that those birds are refueling at your feeder for days and days, but typically those birds are here for maybe a few hours or maybe one night, one day rather. So they all look alike, so it's really hard to tell that you're getting a new crop in every maybe few hours or every day, other day. So these are ruby throats that bred to our north. These could be birds that bred in Minnesota or Missouri or Iowa, and they've got to go to the tropics to overwinter, from Mexico through Costa Rica and a few into Panama, but mostly southern Mexico and into Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and that part of the world for wintering purposes. So it's really cool to see this, because here's a bird that weighs less than two coins in your pocket, really about the weight of one coin in your pocket, and it fuels itself going across country, then gets to the Gulf, and many of them go around the Gulf in fall as they're going south. Some go across the water. But what's really amazing is let's wait 6 or 8 months and comes mid-March, and the first male ruby throats are coming, and those birds hightailed it over the Gulf all by themselves. I don't care if Grandpa told you there's no way that could happen. They had to get on the back of a goose, a duck, something bigger. You know, that's an old wives' tale, and it just didn't sound right for those old-timers to comprehend that little bird could do it all by itself. But it certainly can and certainly does, and it flies all the way across 500-plus miles of the open Gulf, and it's remarkable.
Well, I imagine they fatten up a little bit down there.
That's right.
There in the tropics. So,
yep.
You know, that all of that, that's like every other animal. They fatten up when they need it, and then they spend it when they don't.
That's right. That's right. And it's just, it's a good reminder every year about migration, and September is one of our best, and it's really prominent with the ruby-throated hummingbird, because there are lots of other birds that are migrating, dozens and dozens of species that we just don't see because we're not looking up in the trees for warblers and vireos. We're not looking up at little pepperflecks way up high that are broad-winged hawks and turkey vultures and sharp-shinned hawks. But ruby-throated hummingbirds are coming in at eye level because that's where we have our nectar-giving plants and our feeders, hummingbird feeders, that we can see all this going on. So it's a real easy way to see migration. And again, this is fall migration or southbound migration, however you want to put it. But it's really been great this year. And my wife and I have really enjoyed the ruby-throated hummingbirds this year.
So in the South, there's a term called snowbirds, which are the people from up north who have retired and can afford to come down here during the winter. These are the original snowbirds.
That's right.
And they ain't dumb.
Yeah, and you could probably wait at the border, the Texas border, and start looking at license plates and really see all the other states that are pouring in after the cold snaps. And we're going to get one. We're going to get cold
coming
weather
up
here coming up pretty soon. So that's a good reason for birds. That's the environmental cue to push birds south, especially birds that are insectivorous, because as Dr. Burden will tell us, when it gets to be cold, we don't have a lot of those bugs flying around. They're still here. They're just hiding. They're waiting it out. But what a lot of our birds need, aerial insectivore. They're aerial insectivores, meaning they're catching insects on the wing.
Right.
And so this is a great time to be paying attention to migration and birds fattening up. So
that would be like for us if all of a sudden the cows left and we had no more steak.
We'd follow them.
I would. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm going south where the cows
right,
are.
Right, right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and I have one question. Has anybody ever banded one of those, you know, with a tracker, the hummingbirds to follow their path and get a glide path?
Yeah, the electronics are too big and heavy for that.
I was wondering.
But they have put leg bands on them. They've just not put things like a geolocator or a satellite backpack. All that stuff is just too big
now
and too
heavy. Now
we're
getting into nanotechnology, so that may be coming.
It could be coming. I mean, yeah, it could be coming. So right now they're using tiny little leg bands and recapture rates. You can tell when a bird's coming back because it's got a unique number on that band. You'd have to use a lens to read it because that band is so tiny and the numbers that are stamped into it are very tiny as well.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and our very first call is in. Woody from Lufkin, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff.
Hey.
Have you seen the, I know I had a picture pop up on my Facebook. It was really, really interesting. It tracks a falcon. Have you seen that one?
That's the title of it?
They put a transmitter on a falcon.
Okay.
Female falcon in the tip of South America, and they tracked her all the way straight up the continent.
I've not seen that. I'm presuming that's a peregrine falcon, right?
Right.
Okay.
Some kind of falcon.
Yeah, I would bet. Okay. No, I've not seen that. There are a lot of those, but that one I have not seen. So what would you tell our listeners to look for? Track a falcon? Is that what you called it?
Yeah, I guess. I don't remember what it was.
If you have the link, though, we can find it. Go ahead and send it to us.
It struck me. Well, it was just popped on my Facebook, but what struck me about it is that that bird went almost straight. I mean, you could lay a ruler on its path.
Huh.
Until it got to water.
Yeah.
And then it skirted along the coast and went across Egypt, I think it was. It skirted along the coast and never crossed water.
Yeah. Well,
I thought it was pretty interesting.
Did you say the name Egypt?
I think it was Egypt. I don't know. Maybe not.
Okay.
No, not Egypt.
Okay, because that'd be the old world. That'd be a different species of falcon.
Yeah, well, this one was from the tip of South America. And it was just really uncanny when I looked at it because they tracked it for 45 days.
Yeah.
So it had every geolocation dot for 45 days. And it would come up to water and would not cross it. It just skirted it.
Well, and there are a couple reasons for that. The bigger bodies of water, thermals, which raptors like to use, aren't prevalent. They're not stable over water like they are over land. And also a bigger part is a lot of the diet of a peregrine falcon is found along the water. They eat a lot of shorebirds. They eat a lot of waterfowl. So that's another reason they skirt the water. They are foraging. They're hunting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought it was a real interesting graph.
Yeah. All right, Woody. Well, thank you, and we'll be sure and have listeners look that up. Track a falcon and maybe.
Track a falcon. It was a thing that said they tracked a falcon for 42 days, and here's where she went. Something like that.
You can probably Google those lines and come up with something.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll do that tomorrow then, Woody, when I get to my desk. Thank you for the tip.
42 days.
Yeah.
One of those probably get you.
Right. Okay. Thanks for the call. Bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now. You can get right in, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding birds or the avian world are welcome. And we go next to George from Bossier City. George, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
I'd like to thank Cliff for the advice on the camouflage that worked out extremely well, and I couldn't have been out there without it.
All right.
The mosquitoes were just horrendous. And so I got covered from head to toe, and the camo wasn't very expensive at all.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad that camo doesn't work on mosquitoes, but what does work, George, is pretty tough, is to hold your breath.
Well, wearing it, the long sleeves and the camo gloves and everything, they kept them off me pretty good.
Yeah.
So that... That worked out well. And your other piece of advice of a longer lens, I know I needed one, so tonight we're going to order a longer lens because I'm not only am I not getting the pictures I wanted, but I think I'm trying to get close to the birds and it's disturbing them.
Yeah.
I go out before sunrise and set up, but then I move around and they're trying to eat first thing in the morning and they're not really comfortable. I don't think they're comfortable with me trying to get close to them.
Right, right.
So the longer lens. But I saw something that really had me curious, and it looked to me like what could be described as an aerial dogfight between a white egret, a snow egret, and the blue heron.
Uh-huh.
They were circling, and it appeared that the egret was, at first I thought the heron had the upper hand, and they were circling one behind the other, and finally the heron landed, and the egret went on. But then later on, I was thinking to myself, it looked like the egret had chased the heron out of its territory.
Huh. Yeah, those two species are going after the same prey items, and so they're always fighting over the best space to do their hunting. And I'm looking at my notes, George. For callers, a little reminder, you called last month and asked about... How to creep up on birds, and so that's what you're calling about. You're calling to We talked about camouflage clothing, of course, and so you're calling about that in case any we have any new listeners that are wondering what's going on. So, well, that's good to get some feedback from you, George. So some DEET in addition to the camo, and then you can deal with the mosquitoes. And what else? Did you get restless leg syndrome sitting there for very long?
No, actually, it's one of the most enjoyable things. In the morning like that, I got the perfect spot out there. I got some great pictures of other wildlife, spiders and frogs and stuff like that.
Right.
And of course, the alligators. And I'm not quite as concerned now as I was before because I realized that the spot that I'm in, I'm right up to the water, but the water is very, very shallow going out for several yards. And so the alligator cannot approach me.
Okay.
Looks like a narrow channel, and the birds stay on the far side over there, and I watch them in the morning. It's almost a routine with the blue heron coming along the shore, creeping along there, and looking for food. And I got several pictures of that. I don't know what they're getting out of the whether it's small fish or crawfish. I can't make it out, but they seem to be pretty successful.
Okay.
They'll go down one bank, and then they'll fly across and work the other bank.
Right.
And the egrets seem to have the same routine, and sometimes they'll perch. I got a few good shots of them perching on trees that have fallen in the water.
Uh-huh.
And you can watch them look into the water for a while, and it's kind of like they have two techniques, one walking the bank and the other just sitting on a perch and looking.
And looking, right. Well, that's cool.
I got a picture of a couple of woodpeckers on a tree,
mm-hmm.
and my wife saw the picture, and she said that she saw an article that those were endangered species, but I find that kind of hard to believe. I never did find the article she was talking about.
Yeah.
But I've seen those woodpeckers. I'm assuming they're the same woodpeckers around quite a bit.
We have 8 species of woodpeckers in the listening area. There's a lot more if you spread out across the country. So the chances are it was probably something very common and expected. And the good thing is, and Bill mentioned this earlier in the show, you can send in, pick one or two of your best pictures and send them in to us, and we will help you identify them, and we'll even talk about them on the show.
Yeah.
So try that option as well. And Bill, you want to give them your email address again to where to send those photos?
Yeah, you can email those to WBeckett, that's BECKETT, WBeckett@lsus.edu.
Yeah, don't send us 100 pictures, obviously. Just pick out your top one or two and per species, and we can go from there, George. But we'd be happy to do that. That'd be fun. Now, I've got a question for you. A bigger lens, are you talking 500 millimeter or 6? Or what did you decide on?
I got a Sony camera. I'd much rather have a Canon, but that's what I got. I'm going with a 200 to 600.
Okay.
And I've done my homework pretty well on researching it, and I think it's got the reach. My smaller Nikon, this APS-C camera, and its equivalent is 450 millimeters, the longest reach.
Yeah.
And so I figure 600 should get me there, and because that's one of the reasons why I didn't send any photos. I don't have any great photos of anything that are clear because I'm cropping them so much. But I'll definitely. I have one more question that's been bugging me. I mentioned it last time when I called. In the early morning like that, if I get there at the right time, if I get there early enough, I get to hear a lot of birds.
Uh-huh.
And it dawned on me that would be one way. The only other things I've seen other than herons is I saw a kingfisher. But those birds are so fast, I don't know if I'll ever get a good shot of them.
Yeah.
I saw one on the tree, and 600 millimeters might get me close enough that I could get a decent shot. But I hear them all the time. And I was wondering if you could give me some advice on an app or a program that can quickly teach me the different songs of different birds, so I know what I'm looking for when I hear a bird.
Right. There's a really good app that's free. It's called Merlin, Merlin, And that is, it's basically like a field guide all bundled into an app on your phone that not only has pictures and a little bit of text and a range map like a bird book, but it also has sound. And so you can listen to what all the these birds sound like. And then reaching beyond that, starting this summer, they introduced a new part of Merlin where you can hit a button and point your microphone from your cell phone at the sound, and hopefully it's close. If it's a distant sound, it's going to have trouble picking it up, but it will help identify birds that it's hearing. And it's using the massive Macaulay Library of Sound based at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. And it's not right all the time. I have to say, they've got some wrinkles to get out, but it sure is helpful. It's better than nothing, and I recommend it. I've used it. I've spent time talking on the show about using it in other states and the pros and cons, but there are way more pros than cons. So get the Merlin app, download it, play with that, try it out, and that would help you a lot, George.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, George, before you go, also, when you're out there and you're hearing that beautiful morning cacophony of birds, go ahead and take a recording of that. You can do that on your phone because, one, we like bird sounds, and two, you can send that to us. We might be able to help you identify anything that you're not really sure about.
That's right.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but do you think my cell phone will really pick up that?
Yeah, if you set it out under a tree and just walk away for a while and let it record, it'll pick it up. And whatever it doesn't pick up, I can bring out highlighting-wise through the audio production facilities here at Red River Radio.
Okay, I'll give that a try.
Yeah.
I'm going out this weekend again.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, George. You've got a lot of things on your plate, a lot of to-do things. And it sounds like maybe you've got is this a birthday that's justifying the big expensive lens, or is just every day is George's day?
No. When Cliff Shackelford commands it, I got to do it. So.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, tell the wife that's you know it's a homework assignment, right? That you got to get these pictures.
Happy so. Cliff, happy life.
Yeah. I love it, George. That's great. Well, good luck to you, and do keep us posted by sending us pictures and try out that Merlin app, and all of that's only going to make things easier and a lot more enjoyable. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds or the avian world are welcome. We only have one line tied up right now, so you'll get in pretty quickly. So go ahead and make that call now. And we are going to go next to Lewis from Stonewall. Lewis, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi there. Y'all can hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So first, I have a short, funny story. I drive an 18-wheeler, and I go everywhere, man. Okay. And down a pipeline, I saw some ducks walking around at super bright orange bill and matching legs. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, what is that duck? I called my uncle up, he's a duck hunter. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Later on that same day, I saw some in a cow pasture on the fence post, just sitting around. It looked like they was just chilling. Same duck. I started wondering, man, I know I'm sober, but what am I seeing here? Cause these things are crazy looking. And I looked them up, and it was a whistling duck.
Yep, the black-bellied whistling duck. Yep.
Ah.
Yep, and because there are two species in North America, so there's also a fulvous whistling duck that doesn't have that bright color like the black-bellied, with that hot pinkish red bill and the matching legs. And, you know, certain times of the year that color fades. Also age of the bird, it's not as vibrant. But if you see one in the spring or summer, it's usually a hot reddish pink, pinkish red, whichever you want. But were you in a new part of the world, Lewis? Is that why you hadn't seen these before? Or where were you working that you saw them?
Surprisingly, this was all in DeSoto Parish, all in one day.
Wow.
And I had never seen this duck before.
Yeah.
And there was no water anywhere around. And I was like, I know that's a duck, and there's no water.
And yeah.
That's what really made me wonder whether I was seeing things.
And this is a duck that in the last two decades has just exploded in many directions. If you were a bird watcher 20 years ago, you really had to retreat to South Texas to see one, you know, south of San Antonio, and you'd have a really good chance of seeing one. But something's happened in the last 20 years, and they've said they've decided to go exploring, and they've expanded their range. And so that's neat that you had them in Louisiana, Lewis. So
that may
cool.
be why his uncle didn't, you know, an old timer might not understand. Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Can I squeeze in my question though?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So when I was a kid, Bob White's quail were everywhere, and I don't see them very often anymore. Almost never, in fact. Is there still a hunting? Is it still legal to hunt them? And I find that if it is, I find that to be very disturbing. And so, I'm not going to ask you more questions.
Okay.
I'd like to say that in my own experience, they seem to be, their population seems to be down, and it's still legal to hunt them. Here we are in the sportsman's paradise, and maybe there's some politics in play, but I think there's a problem.
Yeah, there definitely is, Lewis, and I'm glad you brought that up. And we've talked about the decline and sometimes extirpation of northern bobwhite, also called quail, bobwhite quail, especially in our listening area. They have just declined in big numbers because of things we're doing to the land. People drive around, they see green pastures, and they think, oh, it's a grassland bird. There's grass everywhere. Wrong species of grass. This is non-native grass we've brought in. A lot of it's coastal Bermuda. It's just a carpet grass. It gives no protection, nowhere to hide for a quail that is stage fright. It does not want to be front and center. They want to hide in between the clumps of native grasses, things like bluestem, and Indian grass and many other species of grasses that are native. So we've changed our grasslands in our forests, in the pine forests here in the West Gulf Coastal Plain. We used to have fire maintained pine systems that fire would be low intensity, would sweep through and maintain grasses and forbs that were very good for bobwhite. So the woods were full of bobwhite. But what we've done is we've cut those down and replanted them and super stocked with pine those stands where it's now growing two and three times too many pines, shading everything and not allowing grass to grow. You can't have quail without grass, and you can't have grass without sun. So if you have a pine stand that is just bumper to bumper and shaded underneath, you won't have grass, you won't have quail. So these are things that humans have done. We have done this, and we have basically unknowingly removed quail from our area. And yes, it's still legal to hunt them, but I challenge a hunter to go out and find some in this listening area. There are very few areas where you would even bother doing it. It's
right.
Not, you wouldn't waste your time. You'd have better luck just going on go out with your metal detector and look for jewelry out in the middle of nowhere, because you'd have probably an easier time with that. So there's no politics involved as far as the hunting. Instead, it's just the way that we are managing our lands. We are doing it for higher yield in pine, and that goes back to what I said about too much shade. And then in our grasslands, we're trying to get a higher yield of beef production. And so what we've done is we've gotten rid of the native grasses and replaced them with things from the Mediterranean, from other countries, from other continents even. And those grasses don't mix with the native birds. So we've seen huge declines in bobwhite, loggerhead shrike, eastern meadowlark, all kinds of sparrows, all kinds of other songbirds. Yeah. Because the grasslands aren't right. So if you drive around and you see green pastures and say, that guy on the radio doesn't know what he's talking about, it's the wrong kind of grass. And it's just like, you know, if you wanted to get a really good tasty pie, and I told you the best pie is the one that's been in a wrapper on the shelf for the last 6 months, and you bite into it and you go, that is the nastiest pie. That's not a pie. You know, the best pie is the one that comes right out of the oven, that's fresh, that's made with love, with homemade ingredients, And that's right. Exactly what we're missing with habitat. It doesn't have that love and those homemade ingredients anymore.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call, Lewis. Right.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds or the avian world are welcome. And that brings us up to our next picture that we have online. Anybody recognize that sound? Not you, Cliff. All right. Our next picture is from Malik Shahir. And, you know, it's not the best photos. There's two of them there. But you can get the outline of this particular bird, which is a larger bird than the hummingbird, for sure.
That's right. It's crow-sized, and it's not at all close to being a photograph that you'd put in your, you know, in your magazine or you know, put it on in a book. But
you do catch the outline, and that's the important.
For this purpose, yes. For this purpose, you can see that it has a black back. And that's critical for telling the pileated from the other large woodpecker that we have not seen in quite some time, and that's the ivory-billed woodpecker. And so this is the way to do it. Take a picture of your bird in question and then send it to us, and we can help you identify. It doesn't need to be the quality of a magazine cover, but these are really good enough to tell that this is the expected pileated woodpecker.
And if you happen to hear this... You got a pileated in your backyard.
That's right.
Or in the woods near you. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we still have lines open. You will get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Next up on our questions, Angela Bratton submitted this photo. She says, yes, the pics are not the best. The beautiful hawk was very high in the sky, and I had a terrible camera. Can you identify? His colors appear to be gray and white.
Yeah, scroll down a little bit for me. It's not on my screen here. We're sharing
screen.
Okay, so this is fuzzy. No, that's not a complaint because I can see one of the best features from her photo, and that's these pale little crescents or these pale little windows near the end of the wing. So they're the base of the primaries. When you see those, it looks like you're looking through a glass window, so to speak. And that's only the red-shouldered hawk has that. And so the immatures, those crescents are a little buffy. On the adults, it's a little white. Sometimes if the lighting's wrong, you won't see it. But this one is backlit, I think, is the reason why you can really see that those pale crescents of the red-shouldered hawk. So cool picture.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have all lines open right now, so you'll get right in. And we're going to get to our last, I can't see that, Cliff. You'll just have to say it. All right, we're going to get to our last photograph. And this one, these are two nice photographs submitted by Chuck Olmay, and they're already identified as the American Bittern. But his photos are quite good.
Yeah, Chuck sent some pictures in, and it's a really cool species. It's a bittern. It's related to a heron and an egret. This one really likes to hang out in the reeds and the cattails and the tall marshy grasses. And when they're spotted or they're nervous, instead of flushing, they point their bill straight up. And the markings on them are very streaked, and they look just like the grasses. And you can see that in Chuck's second picture. And if you didn't know that camera was pointing at that bird, they're motionless, you would walk right past that, not even knowing that bittern is there in his second picture. So really cool bird, the American bittern.
And it is a very, very cool photograph there by Chuck Olmay.
Yeah.
So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we need calls right now. So go ahead and give us a call at 800-552-8502. Go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, this is a good time for a homework assignment that I have for all of our listeners.
See, you should have called in. Now you're getting homework.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to hang up or turn off the radio, or if you're streaming, don't turn the computer off. This is a super easy homework assignment that is going to mean a lot to our wildlife. And we've talked about something called RAWA, the acronym for Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And we've talked about it several times on this radio show. So Recovering America's Wildlife Act is a bipartisan bill in Congress that aims to reverse the wildlife loss in our country. It dedicates critical funds to restore lost habitat and recover at-risk wildlife populations, kind of like what Lewis talked about earlier when he brought up the Bob White. The bill would be voted in committee soon, so we encourage everyone to contact their congressmen in their area, especially these three congressmen in our listening area, because they are also part of the 48-member Natural Resource Committee. And those are Louis Gohmert. If you live in District 1 in Northeast Texas, please contact Louis Gohmert. Tell him you support RAWA, that you support wildlife, that you want more birds, and RAWA would do it. If you're in the southern part of our listening area, getting close to Baton Rouge, there's Congressman Garrett Graves. If you're in Louisiana District 6, same thing. Call that congressman and let them know that you love wildlife. And the third one is in Southwest Arkansas, Bruce Westerman. If you're in Arkansas District 4, please contact Westerman and let him know that you're interested in wildlife. If you're not in any of those districts, you can still call your representatives, and it'll take you 3, 4, 5 minutes top to get online, Google your representative's number. Sometimes your local paper includes their phone number or their website, and you can call and just spend a couple minutes on the phone with the aide that picks up the phone and just say, hey, I'm calling. I live in your district. I'm a voting member, and I really like wildlife. I love wildlife, and I really want RAWA to pass. RAWA is not going to be any new taxes. It's going to be using existing funds, and so it'll be available to states with a 25% match to do things like we talked about earlier, to reverse this decline that we talked about earlier with the Bob White, to bring these grasslands back that are needed by so many species, not just grasslands, but so many species. And the thing I like about Bob White, it's what we call an umbrella species. You can do something for that species, and so many other species are covered under that same umbrella. So it's really beneficial. So please call your rep, especially if you're in Gohmert, Graves, or Westerman's districts. Please call them, because they are on that Natural Resource Committee. That was going to go to vote tomorrow, but it has been postponed. And so the only word I have is that it will be voted on soon. But I would say if you call this week would be great. So if you're listening to us live, call tomorrow. If you're listening to us a few days later, because a lot of people listen to us later on podcasts, still have time to call in the month of October. Please call and let those people know that you support RAWA, that you want funds to go to reverse declines in a lot of species, because wildlife is important to us. They're good. They provide jobs. They're good for people. It's good for the economy.
Ecotourism.
It generates a lot of money. And you know, if you're a hunter, if you're an angler, you get it. Bird watchers get it. Everybody should get it, that wildlife is important to us. And getting out in nature, we've talked about that on the show. It's just better for your blood pressure. It's good for the soul. So RAWA is going to help a lot of species, including humans. So
yeah, if you think of everything as a big web, you start cutting strands of that web, and all of a sudden things fall through.
That's right.
800-552-8502 is the number to call to get into Cliff right now. And we do have Laura from El Dorado. Laura, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Mrs. Shackelford, can you hear me all right?
Yes, yep. Ma'am. Go ahead.
I live way out in the country, and a lot of people would love the birds that I have access to every day. We're blessed with many pileated out here.
All right.
So what I want to know, and I don't want to become your enemy, but I have so many owls, O-W-L-S, so many owls out here.
Uh-huh.
Cliff, why do I have so many owls out here?
Well, you live in the country, and the chances are you have a territorial pair of owls of a given species like barred, B-A-R-R-E-D. If you've got pileated woodpeckers, you've got barred owls, B-A-R-R-E-D. And they're very loud.
I've seen barred owls here.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And so when you say lots, you just really have that one pair that are maintaining a territory that is probably overlapping with your property. But you don't have 10 and 20 barred owls. That just doesn't happen. They're not flocking. They're not moving around a lot. One pair needs probably 150 to 200 acres of quality habitat. And if you stick a lake in there, that doesn't work because they're not fish eating. They're not going to swim. You stick some pavement, rooftop, that doesn't count. So good quality habitat is going to be some deep, dark woods, and I suspect that's what you've got. So owls are good neighbors to have, Laura. You know, they're eating pesky critters that we don't like
rats.
To have, and we don't want them in excess. I mean, we have a place for, you know, reptiles and mammals that some of us deem as pesky. But these are things that the barred owl feeds on, and they also eat crawfish. They'll eat squirrels. If we had too many squirrels, they would, you know, gnaw holes in our houses and chew up our wires and start more house fires. So we need owls. We need hawks because they're doing us a free service.
Well, I'm blessed to also see red-tailed hawks here. Thank you for teaching me what I needed to know.
Great. Thank you.
I do know that the web, the whole web, every part of it is important. We found a 7-foot snake skin last weekend. Mm.
All right. That's awesome.
Everybody wants to live in the country, but you really ought to try it sometime. We've got 30 acres. I appreciate what you do, sir.
Well, wait, before you go, Laura, go ahead and record some of those owls for us with your phone. If they're hooting out there, you can just set your phone on a table or on a rock or take an old canister or something like that and turn it over and then walk away for a while and capture some of the recordings because we love our bird sounds.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
You won
Laura.
Me over.
All
God
right,
bless
cool.
you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we still have a little time left, so if you get in right now, you can get your phone call in. In the meantime, I thought we would revisit some species that are actually fooling us. Species of animals that sound like birds, but are actually other ones. So we're going to, this is Stump the Cliff, and I'm not going to stump him because he knows he sounds so.
We didn't rehearse this. So
no,
I'm
we
interested.
Didn't. This is called throwing it to Cliff right now.
All right.
So let's listen to the first one.
Yeah.
Now, if I heard that at night, I would think that is kind of a bird sound.
It sounds very bird-like, and you can hear these in the day. And we've talked about this. This is the gray tree frog.
Right.
And they do sound very bird-like. And I know a lot of bird watchers, new bird watchers that, excuse me, that haven't learned that because they run over there and they're intensely looking in the tree for a bird, and nothing ever flies, nothing ever moves. It's because it's a frog that is probably not going to move much. He's calling up in the tree. So, gray tree frog.
And here's the next one.
Chirp, 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 chirp. This one, when we first started the show, we learned that we had to profile this because we were getting a few calls. And at my agency, at Texas Parks and Wildlife, we get a lot of calls, people saying there is this bird calling outside. We have our windows open. It's fall or it's early spring, and we want the windows open. But there's this bird that chirps all night and keeps us up. It's so annoying. Well, it's not a bird. That's the Rio Grande chirping frog. And it is tiny. It's about the size of your thumbnail and your finger. I'm sorry. Yeah, your fingernail. And it's going to hide in the bushes. So when you go out thinking, oh, it's somewhere this bird is somewhere in the bushes, and you turn on the light and it stops calling, it's not because it's a bird that flew away. It's because it's a frog that all of a sudden went from dark to light and doesn't like it. He stops chirping. And so you turn the light back off, you go back into bed, and everything gets relaxed outside. And guess what? Chirp, 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 chirp. He starts calling again. So it's the Rio Grande chirping frog. They have exploded outside of the Rio Grande, South Texas area because of mainly hitching rides on potted plants.
Yeah.
So when a business sells plants and they travel through certain areas, you'll notice this. If you buy plants, they'll sometimes have a fire ant mound inside the pot.
Mm-hmm.
So the Rio Grande chirping frog could be in that plant hiding and sitting still, and all of a sudden you've released them into your area. So Rio Grande chirping frog sounds like a bird, but it ain't.
All right. And now it's time for our conservation tip, Cliff.
Great. Tonight we're going to talk about lift, drift, pull, and troll. Jingles that rhyme often work for remembering important tasks, like lefty loosey, righty tighty when trying to turn a bolt or a screw. The same goes for anglers and boaters in our Gulf Coast waters where native seagrasses occur. Lift, drift, pull, and troll as the jingle goes. Seagrasses are native flowering plants found just offshore in calm, shallow saltwater bays. They are made up mostly of shoal grass, star grass, and turtle grass, among other species, and occur in large areas known as seagrass meadows or seagrass beds. Seagrass beds are like coral reefs in that they provide food and shelter for many other critters, especially nursery habitat for estuarine fishes, and are a major source of organic biomass for coastal food webs. Plus, they're effective agents for stabilizing coastal erosion and sedimentation, and they're critical for nutrient cycling and water quality. Since 2013, it's illegal to cause any rooted seagrass plant to be uprooted or dug out from the bay or saltwater bottom by a submerged propeller within the coastal waters of the state of Texas. This Class C misdemeanor fine can be up to $500. So to avoid causing damage to seagrass, remember the jingle: lift, drift, pull, and troll. This means lift your boat motor, drift over the seagrass beds, pull through the shallow water, and troll with your trolling motor. Texas has lost well over half of its seagrass meadows, so let's do our part in protecting them because they're necessary for fish, birds, and other marine life. Do it for the birds.
And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our statewide ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Cliff, I want to thank you once again for driving all the way up from beautiful Nacogdoches to join us
here.
Well,
thanks, and thanks for the little reminder about these frogs that sound like birds.
There you go.
Yeah.
You never know.
If I was a frog, I'd want to be like a bird, too, so I don't blame them.
Yeah, because the bird might eat the frog, but the frog ain't going to eat the bird, not that little thing.
That's right.
All right, you have been listening to Bird Calls. And Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this show and for loaning us Cliff for this program. Tonight's program was made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and we had phone bank assistance tonight by Wally Derleth and Tim Schnell. The sound files used in tonight's profile species was from xenocanto.org and was recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio from tonight's program will be posted on our website in a few hours, and you can listen to the program again at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you'd like us to identify, you can send it to my email address, wbeckett.com. That's WBECKETT at LSUS.edu. That's WBeckett at LSUS.edu. Next week, join us for What's Bugging You on Tuesday, October 19th at 6 p.m. And be sure to join us for the next Bird Calls on Tuesday, November 9th.